Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, Manhattan Beach 360, on February 12th, 2016. Live, love, laugh, and leave a legacy. That's what we do here in the South Bay of Los Angeles, and it's a beautiful place to do just that. I'm your host, Joe Terry.
The South Bay Show is brought to you by the Manhattan Beach Chamber of Commerce. The Manhattan Beach Chamber of Commerce has been serving the city of Manhattan Beach for over 60 years, and they are dedicated to promoting a strong local economy by supporting the community, providing valuable business connections, and representing business with government. The Chamber staff is focused on providing its membership with the tools and resources to help businesses grow and thrive within the community. Their goal is to continually support the individual efforts of business as they work to support the growth of the local economy. For more information on how the Manhattan Beach Chamber of Commerce is working with member businesses and the City of Manhattan Beach to support that growth, visit the website at manhattanbeachchamber.com or call 310-545-5313.
You can read all about our many adventures on Facebook at facebook.com/The South Bay Show. Persistence, passion, principle, and purpose. That's what we talk about here on The South Bay Show. And, of course, I'm not alone because of our great partnership with SouthBayByJackie.com and producer of The South Bay Show, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well this morning, Joe. Today is kickoff for Valentine's weekend.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And it's special because it's a three-day weekend, and Valentine's Day on Sunday, it's going to be a big one.
Yeah, it's a nice long weekend. So I would imagine that a lot of lovebirds are getting out of town this weekend.
Yes.
But there's still a lot going on in town, if you are in town. Yeah.
There's a lot going on, and, you know, Jackie, there's just a lot going on around the country, around in Southern California, in Silicon Beach, you know, with all of the tech startups today, business startups today, you know, partners, it takes on a whole new connotation because now you have so many different things involved. You have, you know, these technological partnerships where there's the money guy and then the coder or the developer. It's very, very difficult to figure all this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
It would be great if we had somebody who really understood all the ins and outs of partnerships to explain how that should work, wouldn't it?
Well, we're lucky we do.
Oh! That's great. Who's our guest today?
Okay, that was just corny. All right, we have a returning guest this morning, Patrick Maloney. A resident of Manhattan Beach, Patrick opened his own law practice, the Maloney Firm, in the South Bay in 2012 after practicing for over a decade at a downtown Los Angeles firm. Patrick has successfully represented businesses in employment matters, contract disputes, disagreements among business owners, intellectual property lawsuits, and suits involving allegations of anti-competitive conduct. In 2012, Patrick received an AV rating from the Martindale Hubble, reflecting that his peers recognized him as having the highest of ethical standards and legal ability. He graduated with honors from the University of San Diego Law School in 1998. Now, this morning, we're going to be discussing the do's and don'ts of business partnerships. Now, I saw Patrick speak on this subject a couple of weeks ago, and trust me, it's well worth your time to hear what he has to say about this. Welcome back to the program, Patrick. We're so glad you could join us this morning.
Good morning. Good to be back. Nice. It was nice to see you the other night.
Yeah, that was a great event. I went to a Manhattan Beach Chamber networking event at Big Door Studios,
mm-hmm.
in El Segundo, and Patrick was the featured speaker. And this is a really important topic, and very, very informative.
Okay, well, we're excited to hear about this because it is such a big deal. Lots of people are thinking about starting businesses. Lots of people have started businesses and begun all the work that's involved in a partnership without the legal work being done first, and that's always a sort of a recipe for disaster. So, Patrick, what is a partnership?
Well, under the technical law school definition that we're all trained with, it's whenever two or more people come together to engage in a business enterprise and either share the profits or losses. But the focus I bring is more to when people get together and form a business, whether they carry it on through a limited liability company or a corporation or a more traditional partnership. The issues that I'm always very interested in are how are they gonna find their relationship and work with one another and try and avoid all the problems that can come out of it down the road.
Mm. Now, I remember I used to work with a company called Manhattan Software many years ago, and I wrote legal case management software, where in the law firm, traditionally constituted law firm, it was a true partnership. It wasn't a corporation, where there was always a case could be split into 3, 4, 5 different ways in terms of how the money flowed from that case. $1,000 could come in and get split between 3, 4, 5 different people, depending on who was participating, who was the rainmaker, as it was called, the person that brought the business in, and so forth and so on. Law firm accounting is quite complex in that way. So, but tell us, how does it typically happen now, not just law firms, which are very special, but with small businesses? Aren't LLCs used more and more these days?
A lot of small businesses are carried through LLCs because they provide a variety of advantages. The traditional professional services firms, like you referred to as a law firm, cannot be an LLC, at least not in the state of California. But how does the money get divided is one of the really significant questions that needs to be dealt with. And you know, the example you've given of a law firm is a really even law firms organized as a corporation still function much like a partnership, and so law firms have varied approaches as to how the money will get divided amongst the various constituents in the firm. And it's a very extreme example because there's things such as origination credit, and there's things such as maintenance credit and working credit. That make law firm partnerships a really good example in some respects of the issues that can come up in partnerships, because those are the sorts of issues that if they're not properly resolved, documented, in the term I sometimes use is calibrated, so that the way the money works through the system is deemed to be fair by everybody. If those things aren't taken care of, the law firms eventually blow up.
Wow. So we know that you have a regular presentation that you've made, and we want to cover the highlights, and then we'll talk about some of the highlights. So I want to give you that platform to take us right from the beginning, the top points about the do's and don'ts of partnership. What are they?
Certainly. And what I try to avoid is getting too far down into the technical details, because those are things that have to be addressed on a one-off basis in the involvement of the partners in a specific partnership arrangement. But I think the big things that we want to talk about, and I think one of the mistakes a lot of folks make, is how they go about selecting their business partners. You know, people put a lot of care into selecting their life partners, and they should probably put a similar level and detail of care into selecting a business partner. Hmm. And then from there, we'll talk a little bit about the importance of getting those written agreements done up front, kind of like using our example, a prenuptial agreement at the outset.
Hmm.
And then we'll talk a little bit about things that folks should do in those agreements to plan for and prepare for how they're going to resolve the eventual disagreement that's likely to arise down the road at some point in time.
Mm-hmm. I want you to continue, but I just have to interject my favorite story about prenups. A great friend of mine, an attorney, would always tell me this story about a friend. And it's a fictional story, but it's a story that he used to explain to his clients why forming a partnership required a lot of sort of thought and pre-work. He said, you know, this guy came to me and he wanted to discuss a prenup with his betrothed, his fiance. And he said, you know, I don't really like her very much, she's kind of ugly. I don't like her family. But the prenup is fantastic. What do you think? And he said, you know, if you don't love her, what's the point? The prenup, it doesn't matter how well it's written. If you don't have a relationship, what's the point? That's the story.
Yeah, no, and really that's a big of what goes into to this first little segue, which is how do you go about selecting your partners? And the very short presentation on selecting business partners is oftentimes, if you don't want to have a dispute with a business partner, simply don't have a business partner. Then you just get to fight with yourself. But, you know, in handling as many partnerships as I've handled over the years, there's a handful of things that kind of consistently show up that I think people overlook when they're going into a business relationship and thinking about who they're going to work with, because they don't think ahead to how the various issues that we're going to talk about are going to later impact their business relationships. And oftentimes what happens is that the enthusiasm for the idea or the opportunity outweighs sometimes common sense. And so, you know, in the list as I've ordered them in no particular order, one of the interesting topics that are things that people I think oftentimes overlook is simply age. And we're handling a matter right now where there's a 65-year-old business partner who linked up with a 40-year-old. And so they're at such different points in life that their outlook on life, their plans for retirement and what have you, invariably will create problems. One person's thinking about riding off into the sunset of retirement, which may result in that individual deciding to liquidate his interest in the partnership, whereas the 40-year-old is in the prime of her earnings career, we'd like to think, and probably has very different views about what should happen with that business. And so that's something that really should be thought about on the way in, because even if the age disparity doesn't present these sorts of issues when two folks partner up, it likely will crop up down the road. You know, and using kind of our, you know, personal relationship marriage is an analogy here. We see that all the time when you have those May December romances, if you will, and people reach retirement and what have you at different points in life. So it's really important to think about age on the way in. And another thing that's really important to think about are goals. What does each person want out of the partnership? I'm handling a new matter that came in since I did the speech that Jackie saw the other night. And one person in the partnership views it as an opportunity to build and sell the business down the road within the next 3 to 4 years and have a liquidity event. The other partner would like to continue to run the business forever. And just maintain it and have it be where she goes to work.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with either of those as general proposition goals, but when two people get together to run the business and they have such divergent views about the future, you're invariably headed for a conflict. Another area that we see crop up a lot is different values. And the law firms are a really good example of this. We talked a little bit briefly, you know, in the parlance, there's the folks use in law firms, there's finders, minders, and grinders. And usually the finder is the person that goes out and generates the business and makes it rain. The minder is usually the other partners who oversee the work, but probably don't have whatever it takes to generate business, whether it's a lack of interest or a lack of ability. And then the grinders are generally the associate employee types. And so one of the interesting things that comes out of that is, within the law firm, do you put more of a premium when you think about divvying up the money on really high quality legal work that the minders might perform, or do you place greater value on the ability to attract the work, i.e. the grinders? And if people don't value those functions at least approximately the same way, invariably there will be hurt feelings because somebody feels they're not being treated fairly on a compensation issue. So that's one example of how different value systems can crop up, and there are certainly others that show up.
Well, I got to ask. So how do partnerships ever get formed? No, I mean, really, so you that second one that you mentioned, the second example about the person that wanted to, that they're creating something and he wants to sell it off in 3 to 5 years and the other person doesn't want that, how do you conclude something like that? How do you come to
The problem in that instance is pretty straightforward. Nobody thought about it before they went into the partnership. The conversation wasn't had. And so now that the business has actually gotten off the ground and started to make some money, people start seeing where things can go in the future and start developing their vision for where they want to go. You know, and again, using our young couple getting married as an analogy, if you don't talk at the outset about whether you want to have 0 or 6 kids, when the time comes, you're going to have that sort of problem.
Yeah.
So it's the same sort of thing. And the reason, I mean, the cynical reason why so many partnerships get formed is because people don't have the conversations that they should that might dissuade them from getting into a partnership with the person they've selected as their business partner. And so therein lies the rub. And, you know, I had a case a number of years ago where there was clearly different values, goals, and ideals between the two partners. And one partner consciously chose not to actually have a partnership agreement with the other partner because he knew that if he forced the issue, they would never be able to reach agreement. And frankly, that should have been a red flag, because they end up in a lawsuit which went to trial and a jury helped sort out the issues after great expense, time, emotional turmoil, and everything else to both parties. So, you know, I think these conversations up front can help people from making bad decisions and avoiding what inevitably we refer to as the business divorce. Other things that
I'm sorry, I just want to highlight for people these gems from the legal profession, which I think you're right is the sort of the source, the well of information about partnerships is the legal profession. Finders, minders, and grinders.
I like that.
It is very important. Thanks, Patrick. Continue, please.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, another thing that's really important is finances. If two folks with really different economic situations get together, that can create problems when one of them decides they need to get a draw to pay their mortgage or buy groceries or something like that, and the other person doesn't need the money. It can create issues related to how money is distributed to pay taxes. It can create a whole range of issues that it's not to say that that folks with unequal financial power can't get together in a partnership, but if there is significant inequality of financial power, then the folks need to think about how that's going to be dealt with down the road. A simple example of a problem that can happen is that if the business needs more infused capital, the wealthier partner has the ability to put more money into the business, but in return for a larger equity stake, thereby diluting the minority partner or the financially weaker partner and resulting in that partner becoming a less and less powerful minority. And so those are issues that need to be dealt with up front. I've seen folks negotiating on their way into a partnership decide it wasn't going to work because of a simple concern of what would happen to the secondary partner, if you will, in the event that more money was required. Because that person knew that he would never be able to make a capital call and had grave concerns that the other partner would use capital calls to eventually dilute his ownership interests in the business down to nothing. And so that's a real concern. And then another thing that we really like to think about when folks are going into a partnership is, you know, relative strength of bargaining power. If you're going to partner up with somebody who's in a much stronger position because they've got the factory, for example, that you need to produce the goods that you're trying to develop, or they've got a lot of strong relationships or what have you, that person's going to have stronger bargaining power on the way in. And that needs to be recognized so that you can protect yourself on the way into the business venture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these are just a handful of the considerations that people should have when they go into partnership. But, you know, much like choosing who to marry, variety of things that you want to think about as you enter the partnership, because, you know, in a perfect world, the partnership goes well, and many of them do. And everybody makes a lot of money and things go great. But unfortunately, just like a divorce in the domestic relations scenario, breaking up a partnership can be remarkably expensive when it comes time to fight over the various issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues that come up when those fights happen can be, you know, many, many issues. And usually somebody starts accusing the other person of using partnership money for their own personal purposes, which then means that we're going to get into a full-blown audit with a forensic accountant.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's painful. It just sounds painful.
Yeah.
Forensic
yeah.
accountant.
Yeah.
Because you know what? Oh, another phrase my friend Bruce always used. You know what forensic accountants do? They probe very private parts of your business.
Yes. Yes.
And it's very painful.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, I've seen this come up in a garment manufacturing company a number of years ago, where our client ended up being a 35% owner with her former boss, who was a 65% owner.
Mm-hmm.
He controlled the board, he controlled the finances, he controlled everything, and he used his strength to do things like purchasing a building that he then caused the partnership to rent from him at an above-market lease rate to siphon money out of the partnership to himself.
Whoa.
And then he loaned money to the partnership at interest rates of up to 25%, having his cronies on the board basically approve the loans.
Hmm.
So that was horrific, and that case had to go all the way through a trial for our client to get her due. You know, we had another case involving a fellow who developed some ideas, couldn't fully exploit them on his own, but started getting some traction that attracted somebody who seemingly would have been a great strategic partner, but frankly was not a very nice guy and was having his own business issues. And so his game plan was to steal our client's idea for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was darn near successful.
He went into the partnership thinking, I'm going to steal this other guy's idea.
You know, he would never admit to that, but boy, oh boy, the emails and such that we got when they had a lawsuit would certainly suggest that that was part and parcel of what was on his mind.
Mm.
And again, that was a case that required a jury to help sort everything out and unravel it. And in both instances, a little bit better planning up front would have helped protect the client that we ended up representing, which was the smaller partner in both instances. And in both instances, there was no written agreement up front, which made it really tough because we didn't have a roadmap as to how the money was to get divided amongst the folks. We didn't have a roadmap to efficient means to deal with these issues. Instead, what we had was the opportunity to go to the courts. And unfortunately, when these issues go to the court system, the minimum amount of time from filing to trial, if you get lucky, is going to be 15 months from the day you file it to the date that the court sets your matter to go to trial the first time. The reality is you're probably looking anywhere from 2.5 to 4 years,
mm-hmm.
given the current backlog in the court system. So you create some real problems for yourself if you don't come up with more efficient means to deal with things, and you don't smoke out the partner that you don't want to be involved in by actually hiring your own lawyer to actually work through and negotiate a really good agreement up front. If you can't agree on the terms of a fair agreement up front, that's pretty much a predictor of what's going to happen in the future if you decide to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we recently represented somebody in a local restaurant who brought on a much younger partner with different views about how the business should be run, going back to the notion of the values and the goals of the partners and how they viewed the business. and that partnership didn't make it 3 or 4 months before it was clear that it wasn't going to work. So those are some pretty gruesome examples of bad things that have happened to folks. And unfortunately, even if you go to court at the end of it and you get a good outcome in your lawsuit against your business partner, when you start figuring the opportunity cost, the transaction cost of the lawsuit, the lost time, the stress and trauma of it all,
right,
even the win probably isn't really worth it at the end of the day. So
I'm totally traumatized just listening to this. Completely traumatized just listening to this. Those are things that can go wrong.
this is in contrast to, you know, the word team, T-E-A-M, together everyone achieves more. There's no doubt that there's a magic to the synergy of experiences, the synergy of skills, the synergy of energy when two or three or more people get together and say, hey, we've got an idea, let's do this. I mean, we have some great historic examples like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak from Apple. They didn't always see eye to eye. There were some knockdown, drag out, you know, I'm never going to speak to you ever again in my life kind of disagreements that ultimately got resolved. But the key is they could not have done it separately. They needed each other. History needed them to work together, literally. How do you reconcile those two things, the difficulty of partnership and the necessity of people getting together and melding their skills and talents and resources to build something great?
Well, you know, in sports they talk about locker room chemistry. And I think that's a good example when you get the right folks together that have a common vision, similar goals, and can find ways to use their differences to work together and build something stronger. You've got great upside potential. And, you know, it's funny when we talk about Apple, then you talk about Bill Gates and, you know, Paul Allen splitting up, you know. But there are certainly a lot of partnerships that do succeed, and it's the partnerships that succeed are the partnerships where the right people got together for the right reasons, made a good, solid business plan, capitalized off one another's strengths, tried to cover up for the other's weaknesses, and really did have things go well in that regard. And so that's why it's so important to really think about who you're going to get in business with up front and think through these issues and really figure out if you're building the team the right way. And, you know, unfortunately, people oftentimes, it seems to me, just rush into things or find themselves in a business without even realizing they are, and give up the planning, and, you know, forego the planning, and then find themselves in having a problem. And those problems always seem to arise in two circumstances, when there's not enough money or there's too much money coming in.
Yeah, it all comes down to the money.
Right.
Hey, listen, this would be a good point for a station break, Joe.
Station break, but
yeah.
Not a commercial.
No commercial, just station break.
Just station break. Well, you've been listening to it. This is the stuff of business life. As it comes back to me, writing software that does law firm accounting was a very traumatic experience. Learning all the ins and outs of doing that was mind boggling. I thought they were doing something that was unusual, but apparently it's not unusual. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the South Bay Show, and we're talking about the do's and don'ts of business partnerships with Patrick Maloney. You know, it's going to be exciting and it's going to be terrifying, but you have to listen to this. If you're going to go forward with a partnership, you need to think about these issues before you go into the partnership. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to have you. Please give us a call at 714-242-2000. 714-242-5288. That's 714-242-5288. We'd love to have your comment, question, or disaster story.
Yes, because as we know, at the start of any business relationship, you know, when a couple of people come together and somebody's got a great idea and somebody else has the skill set to make it happen, it's all wine and roses, you know? It's like every day is Valentine's Day, right?
Right.
And then, as Patrick just said, when the money starts rolling in, things can get hairy.
And so then you have the War of the Roses.
That's right.
That's
right.
Famous.
Oh, we're
funny
in all
movie.
These great little analogies.
It's Patrick. It is something that people have to do. We've kind of established that you have to at some point take on the skills, the resources that you don't have, and put them together with your idea or your skills and your resources to build this greater than, you know, than all of us. The whole is the greater than the sum of the parts kind of enterprise. So, A, you've got to talk about it beforehand. You've got to think about it beforehand. You've got to establish your goals, establish your exit. Another way of looking at it is begin with the end in mind, from Stephen Covey, right? Think about where you all want to end up and then work your way.
I think that's exactly right. And if you can think through those issues, you know, one of the things that comes from it perhaps is you decide that the partnership's not for you with this individual. And that's not a bad decision. Sometimes that's the best decision is to go look elsewhere for a different person to work with, because things are going to be better and smoother down the road. But, you know, in the outgrowth of this entire process, this upfront discussion and trying to find the right partner is really then should be embodied in the written partnership agreement. And that's one of our big topics here. And I can't tell you how many times I get a call from somebody saying, I'm having a problem with my business partner. I ask them a question, I already know what the answer is going to be. 9 times out of 10. The question always is, it's about the second or third question after we figure out whether there's a conflict of interest. The question is, do you have a partnership agreement and can you send a copy of it to me? More often than not, the answer is, no, we don't. Or a variant of it, we started to write one, but we never finished it.
What percentage are we talking about of the calls that you get are in the two categories of we never did it or we never finished it?
Let me think about the partnership disputes on my desk right now. Local company, new client, never got around to getting all the things they needed to get done finished. Another local company, never finished it. Never started it, really. Another local company has one, but it's got brackets in it, indicating that they're critical areas of agreement that were never finalized, so that nothing was ever signed. They followed it in many regards on certain issues, but the other issues where there was no agreement, they didn't get things done. I think I referenced a garment company earlier. No written partnership agreement. The other case I talked about that we went to trial on, that involved a printing type of business. The only document signed by the two partners had probably 30 words of text indicating who owned what percentage and nothing else. So while those
it sounded,
folks
it sounded like a, it sounded like 100% there, Joe. It sounds like
100%. Yeah, no, you know, I'm trying to, but by the same token, we went, you know, I've had a small handful where there are actual full-blown, fully documented agreements by sophisticated parties, and then something came up that nobody expected would happen. And the particular case I'm thinking of was a relationship to develop real estate that the parties entered the partnership in, call it 05 or 06, and we all know what happened in 07 and 08 to the real estate market and the economy in general. And so things that nobody thought would happen did happen, and they hadn't been planned out. At least they had a fairly sophisticated agreement drafted by sophisticated lawyers. the recurring theme is oftentimes this process gets started and never finished because the urgency to get together and get the business together takes precedence over figuring out how that business is going to operate, at least as between the partners and owners mm-hmm. at the outset. And you know, invariably, that's where the issues arise. And oftentimes, it's a good thing to do to just take a step back for a moment and think about it, work your way through those agreements before you get into bed with the other.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in one of these cases, the closing argument which I delivered started out by saying basically, these two folks, you know, they fell in love and they got a little bit pregnant and moved in with one another, and then started thinking about whether or not they actually should get married.
Right. Right. I love that.
A little bit pregnant.
Yeah. And then they started thinking about these issues, and then the problem started cropping up. And by then, their two businesses were sufficiently glued together with one another that they really couldn't effectively be unwound at that point.
Right.
And the fella in that case, the stronger partner basically, for all intents and purposes, stole the weaker partner's business.
Mm-hmm.
Literally stole it and
mm-hmm.
fired him.
Mm-hmm.
So, in all of that, and these folks had been circulating very sophisticated agreements drafted by sophisticated lawyers and couldn't reach agreement on some key business terms.
Mm-hmm.
And that should have really been an indication that things weren't going to work out as between them if they
mm-hmm.
couldn't even get it together during the honeymoon phase.
Right.
Wow.
So, it's a really high margin have either no or a completely inadequate or unfinished partnership agreement. It's astonishing to me that so many people are willing to jump into sophisticated business matters, which can have, you think about the consequences of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't think it through at the outset, it can have adverse tax consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You can be putting your own personal assets at risk if you haven't thought about how you're going to structure the business. You can create all sorts of issues for yourself that you can insulate yourself against by thinking things through up front. And on the topic of taxes, a very simple issue that a lot of folks may not appreciate is this. And this is one of the reasons why you want to be thoughtful if you get into a partnership with somebody who's much richer than you are. Generally speaking, most of these small businesses are taxed on a pass-through basis, which means that if the business earns a bunch of money, that income is attributable to the various partners on their own income tax return, even if the money is not distributed by the business to the partners.
Can you say that once again?
Sure. I'll try and elaborate by giving an example. So if the three of us get together and we form a partnership and our business generates $300,000 worth of profits in a given year and we're all equal partners,
mm-hmm.
but we don't divvy that money up and actually pay it out to ourselves, we'll each still be required to recognize approximately $100,000 of income on our own personal income tax returns and pay taxes on it. So we call that phantom income.
Right.
So now, and that's fine because what you're doing is essentially increasing the basis in the business and reinvesting those funds into the business, and there might be a whole bunch of really good reasons to do that. And it happens all the time because there are very good reasons to do that. But here's the sinister part of it. You needed to get into a partnership with somebody who's got a lot of money to fund the business. And because they're going to put their actual capital at risk, they insist upon substantial ownership interest in the partnership, which
mm-hmm.
gives them the power to decide whether or not to distribute the money,
mm-hmm.
which gives them the power to decide if you're going to suffer an adverse tax consequence by being forced to recognize phantom income, as we just described it. And if you're not financially secure to be able to actually pay the income tax that would be accruing on that income you're required to reflect, but your other business partner is sufficiently well-heeled that they can use this phantom income process and the decision not to make distributions is a squeeze out technique to force you to sell your interest on the cheap.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have a choice. Let's be clear. The IRS is going to say pay up or shut up. They're not going to say, oh, you can pay over time or it's okay.
Sure.
That's
the IRS doesn't care. They are the one of the greatest collection agencies in the world for a reason.
Right.
And so, you know, when we start talking about partnership agreements, one of the things that folks want to do if they find themselves in that circumstance is to have a arrangement whereby the partnership agreement requires distributions in an amount at a minimum to cover each partner's expected income taxes on retained earnings, so that come tax time you get a check so that you can pay your taxes rather than being held hostage. So that's
a very simple phrase. It even sounded simple. It didn't sound very legal or anything.
No, it's what should be done. And I've been involved in more than one case where the controlling partner used phantom income as a strategy to bludgeon the minority partner into submission. So, you know, in talking about partnership agreements, there's a few other things that absolutely should be covered.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, what is your business? What's its scope and purpose?
Mm.
What are you two getting together, or three or four or six or eight or whatever it is? What are they getting together to do? One of the reasons that's really important up front is because of something called the corporate opportunity doctrine. So, using a hypothetical again, if the three of us got together to do real estate development in the South Bay,
mm-hmm.
if somebody comes to me and says, hey, Maloney, we've got an opportunity to build a better mousetrap, literally a better mousetrap to trap mice, that's probably not something that is an opportunity that I am required by my fiduciary obligations to pass along to the partnership.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody comes and says, hey, we've got a real estate development opportunity in Culver City, well, that's not the South Bay, but it's not far, and it's what we've all banded together to do. So what's going to happen is if I take that and it's a home run outcome, you folks are going to say, hey, that belonged to the partnership.
Right.
Mm, right, right.
And if it's a failure, you're going to say, what do you mean you want me to make a capital contribution to cover up that loss?
Right.
Right.
So you want to think about and really clearly define what you're getting together for and what you're doing. And what does that mean? And what obligations do one another have? And thinking through how people should deal with those opportunities and things that may come up. The other thing that's critical is you want, when you get together at the outset, you need to identify who the partners are.
Mm-hmm.
Is it you or is it your other little business? You know, your other LLC is the partner.
Hmm.
Be nice to have clarity on that. And who owns what? And what are the rights that come with their ownership interest? Getting those very simple issues documented up front is significant and really important, because if you don't know who owns what, how do you know how to deal with it when the problems crop up?
Mm-hmm.
Huge issue, and something that really should be thought through carefully because of this finders, minders, and grinders scenario, is distribution of profits. How does the money get divided when things are going well? Who gets what? If somebody's contributed more capital, or they're developing more business, or they were the, you know, inventor of the core technology, how are they going to be compensated for that? And figuring out those issues up front is really important and can avoid a lot of heartache down the road. And the other thing is having a candid conversation on that topic helps flesh out whether there are differences of opinion that are going to become a problem down the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the converse of that is capital calls. What happens when the business needs more money? Who's going to provide it? How are they going to provide it? Are they going to provide it as a loan? If it's going to be a loan, what sort of interest rates are they going to charge? Alternatively, if more money is required, is somebody going to provide it as an equity infusion? And if it's an equity infusion, then what happens to the relative ownership of folks among and between one another? In other words, if the three of us in my hypothetical three-way partnership have a situation where it's time for more money to come in, and you know, only Jackie's got the money to put in. What happens to the other two of us?
Yeah.
Do we now own less?
Money bags, Jackie.
Absolutely. You know, and I touched briefly on tax, which, and when I look at the list of how I generally talk about this, comes up next on the agenda. I won't spend more time on that. But then, what about the admission of new partners and transfers of interests? Mm-hmm. You know, how are those decisions going to be made? And transfers of interest is really important because, in my little hypothetical, you know, what happens if I decide to go grab Jim O'Callaghan from the chamber and have him buy in my place? Do you guys want him in there or do you not want him in there? And what mm-hmm. power do you want to have over that?
Mm-hmm.
Worse yet, I pass away. My wife and I go down on an airplane crash, and now you have two new partners. They're 6 years old and 9 years old, respectively.
Yeah.
Do you want them in the business? You know, so how do those issues work? And those are significant, important issues that come up in the life history of a partnership, particularly if people are thinking about a partnership that can go on for a number of years, or particularly if the partners are vastly different ages such that one may retire before another.
Right.
You want to think about indemnification obligations and who's going to do what to whom, when, and how. If the partnership gets sued, for example, in a sexual harassment case, and this is another real-life example, and one of the individual's partners gets sued, who's on the hook to pay legal fees for that if the partnership hasn't been thoughtful enough to buy employment practices insurance up front?
Hmm.
And I'm handling a case right now where that issue cropped up, and it's the genesis of a dispute between the two partners. Because it was expensive to deal with a lawsuit that was eventually settled essentially as being a nuisance case, but it took some time, energy, and money to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then kind of the last one really on, you know, my list of just general things to talk about to hopefully wake people up and help them understand that it's really important to think these issues through is what I call dispute resolution. In other words, how are you planning ahead now to solve the problems that almost invariably will come up later?
Mm-hmm.
And if people can think about now how to deal with those future problems, that provides a lot of insight on how you're going to interact with folks and what they're going to view important in thinking about different problems and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if nothing else, just the process of working through this partnership agreement very well may cause one or more of the partners to realize that this marriage is not going to be a relationship they want to get into, and may cause them to back out. And oftentimes backing out before you get too far down the road is better than getting well down the road and finding that it's time for a very expensive and stressful divorce. So, you know, those are just a short list of some of the things that people need to think about what they're going to get on paper when they set up the partnership.
When I think about what we've talked about, and I think about what you do as a practice, the Maloney firm, I think, you know, this is almost as important as the actual practice of law involved in forming partnerships and involved in adjudicating disputes. It's almost like there should be a business like a prenuptial partnership consultancy that necessarily, you know, by reason of conflict, did not represent anyone, but they just helped partners go through all the issues before forming a partnership. Are there firms, are there businesses like that?
Well, there's a number of firms in and around the South Bay, for example, that advise business on these issues.
Hmm.
And there's some interesting wrinkles that come out of it, because when a lawyer signs on, if a lawyer signs on to be the lawyer for the business, in this context, he or she probably should not be the lawyer for one of the individuals going into the partnership,
mm-hmm.
because that could create a conflict of interest. And so in a lot of respects, you know, if somebody came to me and said, we're about to start a partnership and I've got this great idea that I've been doing for a few years and I need to get a big pile of money to take it to the next level, and I found Bob here who's willing to put $1 million in, at that point I'd say, great. You know what, I think you and Bob need to each get your own lawyer, because we're talking about an ongoing business and a large amount of money. to sit down and put together just a draft of agreement that embodies what you think the business is supposed to look like and has a lot of the basic provisions, and then each side can work through it and try and help negotiate into a final agreement. Mm-hmm. And then that way, everybody's got somebody looking out for themselves, and then they end up with a fully negotiated agreement. And when there's a partner, when there's an issue that comes up down the road, it makes it real hard for that person to complain about how things went because they had their own separate representation in forming the agreement, looking out for them, and they understand the trade-offs they made to get certain provisions in that agreement versus foregoing other things or what have you.
Well, Joe, as he said, as Patrick said early, very early in the show, a lot of people are they find themselves in business with somebody without really even realizing it.
Right.
You know, I mean, I would imagine that happens a lot.
Yeah,
it does quite a bit. You know, we have a situation right now where we're having a tough time figuring out what our client's relationship with the business is. He's been held out as an employee,
mm-hmm.
which would mean he should have been paid on with a W-2 and withholdings from his paycheck. Well, that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
He's been held out as a partner, which means he should have gotten a K-1 if the tax structures were handled correctly.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he's been paid as an independent contractor on a 1099 basis.
Because that was the simplest form to fill out.
I don't know why it was, but each of those relations has different rights and obligations that go along with it.
Hmm.
And so the simple failure to identify what the relationship is up front is creating a problem. And from a strategic perspective, we're trying to figure out what is the best characterization for our client and baiting the other side into taking that position.
Right.
Okay, Patrick, let me ask you something. So say Joe and I are talking about forming a business, a formal business partnership. Can we come in and talk to you about all of this stuff ahead of time?
Absolutely.
Instead of waiting to have to hire you to go to trial.
No, absolutely, and that's what I'm saying you should do.
Mm.
Okay.
You know, and a lot of times, frankly, I'm always happy to go to lunch with some folks and tell them, here's all the horror stories and things you need to think about and scare them straight.
Right.
Because they, you know, we're talking about just forming the relationship. We could spend hours on it and then talking about how they need to set up the systems and procedures, the employment issues, and all of that sort of stuff. So probably once or twice a quarter, I end up going out to lunch with somebody who just wants to ask me, what do I need to be thinking about?
Mm-hmm.
And those are at least people that are thinking ahead to where they want to go, and how they want to get there, and are planning for things. And you know, the biggest excuse we hear is, it didn't make sense to spend a few $1,000 on a partnership agreement at the outset because we didn't have a business yet and we weren't making any money.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the wrong way to look at it because the process that we've talked about going through to negotiate the partnership agreement in and of itself can help really identify and resolve issues before they come up. And then also, they can also help provide in the systems that should be used to resolve the disputes in a much more economical fashion than having a knockdown, drag-out lawsuit. That is time-consuming, and much like domestic litigation, family law-type matters, I find that the partnership lawsuits are quite stressful for everybody involved. They're very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Usually there's feelings of betrayal,
mm-hmm.
You know, sorts of emotions and feelings and positions that you don't see exist in a simple case where somebody bought goods from somebody else and decided not to pay for them,
mm-hmm.
you know. That's a pretty straightforward thing. So, you know, and that's probably just really, you know, to our final topic, which is, you know, what should we be looking at in a partnership agreement to help solve these disputes if and when they do arise? And there's a few real simple things that can be done. You know, one of the things that everybody should think about in a partnership agreement is a buy-sell.
Hmm.
In other words, we're going to agree in advance how we're going to split up, if you will, by one of us buying out the other if we have a problem.
Right.
And the reason you want to do that up front is because at the outset, you don't know whether you're going to be a buyer or a seller in the event that the buy-sell agreement is triggered, which means that you have to be fair and balanced in your approach right up front. And you also need to think about if you're the 40-year-old partnering up with a 65-year-old in the example we gave prior, you're more likely the buyer than the seller.
Mm.
So you want to think about those issues up front. And there's a variety of issues that go into thinking about the buy-sell agreement and how you work through it. Some other things that really should be thought about that can help solve disputes are mandatory mediation provisions. Mediation is a process where you get an experienced lawyer or a retired judge. I've even heard of priests, clergy, somebody like that people trust and respect, helping the parties negotiate through the dispute, kind of like a family counselor in the family law setting, to continue kind of that analogy. And to make that process meaningful, you can put in a provision that in the event that the dispute goes anywhere, nobody's going to get to recover their legal fees unless they've meaningfully participated in a mediation. So you create some back-end pressure that forces folks to go through that mediation and hopefully at least air their grievances with one another and find a resolution before getting into a nasty process. Another thing is arbitration, which is a word that a lot of folks confuse with mediation. Arbitration is where you actually enlist the services of a third party or a panel of third parties to serve as the decider, if you will. And one of the great benefits of arbitration, and I can go on for hours about the pros and cons of arbitration, but one of the great benefits in this setting is that you can get to a decided resolution by the person who's in power to make the decision much more quickly than you can through the court system. And that can be really important when you're trying to have a business continue forward, because if it takes you 3 years to get trial, the business is in turmoil during that period, whereby if you can get to an answer in arbitration in 90 days, you can get back to doing what you need to do.
Right.
And then some other interesting things that folks can do is if you got two relatively equal partners, appoint a third party to serve as the tie-breaking vote in the event that you need a third vote on an issue, things of that nature. But all of these, the value and benefit of thinking about all of these processes in advance is that you're figuring out early how to solve the problem that's likely to come up and doing it in a fashion that everybody agrees is going to be how we're going to do it. And hopefully when a dispute does arise, it can be squelched before it destroys the business.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody can continue on and not waste money hiring the likes of me, unfortunately.
Wow. This hour has flown by. It's amazing, and the reason is, I think, because it's that kind of life experience that anyone who's been involved in business or anyone who's contemplated being involved in business is really going to either have had experiences like this before or will have. Everyone needs this kind of information. It's just critical. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure, just like last time and like it was to see Jackie the other night.
Patrick Maloney from the Maloney Firm. How do people get in touch with the Maloney Firm?
Well, we've got a website that's at www.maloneyfirm.com, and Maloney is MALONEY.
Hmm.
Or they can give me a call. The direct line here at the office is area code 310-540-1505.
Wow, this has been so informative and scary.
That's scary, very scary.
it's amazing. Just MaloneyFirm.com. It's so easy, and obviously you've put a lot of energy and effort into organizing this information in a way that's easy to understand, but there's so much to it. There's so much to it. I know people are just want to get on with whatever they're doing. Let's just get on with the business. No, you need the agreement or whatever you're going to do. You need it. Thanks so much, Patrick, for joining us
today. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Jackie.
Always a pleasure, Joe.
Well, happy Valentine's Day to everyone out there. Have a fantastic 3-day weekend. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye now.